Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 7:41 a.m. That is Pacific Standard Time, and today is Friday, and it is January 5th. So this is the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And what I'd like to talk to you today about are three, I think, big topics. One is that there are, I think, a nascent indications that inflation is beginning to rise once more. Then there's the recovery that we're getting in commodity prices, and then there's technology. Well, when we look at the Dow Gold ratio, there are a number of important points that are really do stand out. The first is that this is one of the longest-term ratios that we have. It goes all the way back to the early 1900s. So we have evidence of three major manias: one in 1929, one massive bull market back in the late 1960s, and then this phenomenal bull market in the 1990s. That the fact that there is a just about a 36 or 35-year interval between the peaks is also a rather interesting consistency characteristic, and it coalesces rather interestingly also with the Kondratiev wave in terms of the distance between peaks in these long-term cycles. So if we were to go back and look at commodity prices, not just over a few years or even a century, but centuries, we would get this same interval between massive manias and this run-up in commodity prices, and then the subsequent long-term underperformance of commodity prices. The lows are not nearly as consistent as the peaks. Each of the peaks has been higher than the last, but the lows have not. The low that we had in the early 1930s was higher than the one that we had in the early 1980s, and not least because one was a deflationary environment and the other was an inflationary environment. Then we had a deflationary environment around 2008-9-10. And we've had a substantial rally in this ratio since 2011, and that corresponded with the peak in gold and with the breakout. Well, it wasn't quite yet the breakout that we had in the S&P 500 out of its 13-year range, but it wasn't that far off it either. And what this suggests is that we are in a secular bull market for equities, and that the potential is that by the time we roll around to about 2035, which would be 36 years from that peak in 1999, that if this 100-year trend is going to, and it's more than 100 years, trend is going to remain consistent, then this ratio will be at a new all-time high, and that will represent a peak of at least a decade-long significance, that equity markets will have a very big decline, and then we'll go sideways for at least another decade after that. So it might be at 2050 before we get another secular bull market in equities starting, by which time I will be older than David is today. So that helps to put human life in the context of these long-term bull markets, that each of us can really only hope to live through one or maybe two of these secular bull markets, and it really does depend on when we are born. And that is equally the case in terms of an inflationary cycle, that you have to be in your 60s, or really probably more like your 70s or 80s, to have a professional memory of what it's like to live through an inflationary cycle. And that's important because people who work in the financial industry don't generally tend to be all that old, and that I have to, even on this long-term chart that I've created on Bloomberg, I still have to go back and adjust the dates because it doesn't give me enough history to put in the peak in this long-term chart of yields. But what I see clearly on this chart is a base formation developing, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to get the breakout today or tomorrow or next month, but if what it does suggest is that the lows are in, and that is a very big consideration, that if we have the lows that if lows have already been formed in long-term government bond yields, this is a very significant event because it changes the dynamic. When we lived through this disinflationary period all the way through from about 1981 onwards, well, then that is in the wisdom or the received wisdom of the market, that all you have to do is buy the dips in bonds and you'll be all right. And eventually that strategy will stop working. And when it stops working, it's going to create an existential crisis in the investment industry, because when one takes regulatory exams or when one looks at what is being suggested for the majority of both retail and institutional investors as to what they should own, then it's always going to be some sort of split between fixed income and equity. And the conventional assumption is that it is the equity which is the risky asset class, and it is the bonds which will offer security. And that has certainly been the case since the early 1980s. But in an inflationary environment, not one where we get a brief bout of inflation, but one where we're back on a secular inflationary environment, well, that split between bonds and equities is going to be deleterious to one's wealth because of the inflation effect. That bonds are one of the worst assets to own in an inflationary environment because they can't raise their yields, they can't raise their coupon. But equities can. So, therefore, rather than being 60-40, bonds to equities or 50-50, then there is a legitimate argument for looking at alternative ways to acquire yield and security. And one of the ways to do that is to look at companies that are increasing their dividends in an aggressive manner. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the dividend aristocrats who have got long records of increasing dividends, regardless of economic conditions, but it would rather be the kinds of companies that can raise their dividends above the rate of inflation are probably going to be the kinds of companies that will benefit in an inflationary type of environment. Some of the reasons that we're getting inflation are, I think, institutional in nature, and some of them are social. And when we're talking about an event that has been underway since the early 1980s, then we have to at least consider the social component. Because since the early 1980s, we have had globalization, and then we have also had offshoring. And these two trends have moved in, they've been almost a symbiotic relationship, and both have progressed progressively in a lockstep fashion. The more globalization we've had, the greater the impetus there has been for offshoring. And what that has done has created this synchronized period of global economic expansion, which we're back in again, because globalization has unleashed the economic potential of a much larger proportion of the global economy. That we have an additional 2 billion people that are going to be entering the global economy over the next 20 years, and they aspire to the standard of living that we, many of us in the OECD, take for granted. But there is the flip side to that, and it is that in a number of Asian countries in particular, living standards have already risen to an approximation of what living standards are like in the West. That if you are a middle class person in Jakarta or Manila or Guangzhou, then the relative comfort that you have approximates to a greater or lesser extent that which a lower middle income person is probably enjoying in the West. And for the person in the West, that represents a pretty bad outcome because their living standards haven't really improved by all that much in much of the last 10 to 15 years. Whereas for the new middle class person in Asia or in Latin America, then they have seen a massive jump in their standards of living. So When we look at where are the inflationary pressures likely to come from, well, obviously high growth economies generally tend to have a bit more inflation because they haven't got the infrastructure that is required to really keep cost pressures under control. And that's the kind of inflation that I think most people are pretty used to. But what we have the potential to now see in the West in particular is a different kind of inflation, which will be socially driven because of these masses of people who have not seen their living standards improve for such an awfully long time that they are voting for fiscal largesse. They simply want more money. That is an almost primal call that people want more money, and they are going to continue to vote for divisive characters at populist causes, which, on a very base instinct, are also, to a greater or lesser extent, racist or xenophobic or populist. But all of these are merely symptoms of the wider problem that living standards have not gone up for decades for a substantial number of people, and in to the extent that a community has been the victim of globalization and offshoring, then in fact living standards have deteriorated. So what the USA is engaging in right now is a fiscal stimulus, regardless of the fact that that is completely pro-cyclical, that we're in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and the expansion in the US economy has been going on now for the better part of 9 years already, and that now they are embarking on a fiscal stimulus is the very essence of a pro-cyclical strategy. And it has the potential to stoke inflation. It has the potential to also create an asset bubble. That is, I think, something that we have to be very much aware of. And it has also the potential to send these yields up and out of this long-term range. Well, if we contrast what this range that we've had in the bond markets with what is going on in gold, well, then we have an interesting scenario because gold prices have also been ranging for just about 2 years. They had a pretty impressive rally in the beginning of 2016, and now they're pushing back up towards the upper side of this range. And gold prices generally tend to do best when inflation is running faster than central banks are willing to raise interest rates. And if we do have inflation coming back into the realm of the possible, then there is the potential that the central banks are going to be caught flat-footed and that inflation will pick up. And gold is not expensive at these levels, that it's currently around $1,300. The peak was much closer to $1,900, and it has And we also have to bear in mind that one of the reasons that we get commodity bull markets is because of the rising cost of marginal production. And gold production costs have taken a step higher. For the vast majority of gold miners now, their production costs are somewhere in the region of about $900. So that is substantially above where it would have been more than a decade ago. And that also gives them leverage to the gold price, and they haven't been able to claim that for really quite a substantial period of time, that they spent all of their money investing in additional new supply all the way through the bull market in gold prices. And then what that had resulted in is a lack of free cash flow, and the majority of the gold shares collapsed in value when gold prices peaked in 2011. So they're back in a position where they are accruing free cash flows because they're no longer investing every available dollar in additional new supply. And that is, I think, a characteristic that is applicable to just about all of the mining sectors globally, because they went through this incredibly painful process of rationalization. And now they're reaping the rewards of a recovery in commodity prices, and the FTSE 350 mining index has broken up and away again this in the last 3 weeks, and is now at new recovery highs and remains on this recovery trajectory, having largely taken a hiatus in 2017. When we look at the London Metals Index, and again from a long-term basis, well, then we get at this a very, very choppy environment where you have the crash in 2008 and a V reversal and a retest of the peak in 2011, and then this very lengthy deterioration all the way between 2011 and early 2016. And now we're back on this recovery trajectory. But it would be wonderful if we could see this for much, get a lot more data on this index, but unfortunately that's just not available. So perhaps it would be better to look at the copper price. Because if we look at the copper price, then we get a lot more data, and what we then see is something that is evident in a, and I don't think it will go back further than 1986, because Bloomberg didn't exist before then, and they just don't have the data from the 1970s. But what we can see here is this step in the marginal cost of production, that the previous peaks become the new floor. And now we're in this still a big rangy environment, and this range is relatively similar in terms of the amplitude of the move that to what we saw all the way back from the 1980s range. That this is really quite similar to what we've seen in previous cycles, that commodity prices take a step higher in nominal terms, but that in inflation-adjusted terms, that commodity prices tend to trend lower over time, but that in nominal terms, they tend to have these steps. And we can see that most clearly with the oil price. So if we look at the historic oil price, which is only updated once a month, but it goes all the way back to the early 1900s, and in fact, it goes back to the late 1800s. Then what we see is that commodities represented by oil in this case tend to have big bull markets and then very lengthy periods where nothing happens, and then very big bull markets subsequently. And this is a dynamic environment. That one of the things that we talk about in the chart seminar on the very first day is, does a breakout change the fundamentals of the market? And the obvious answer is no, because when the breakout occurs, it's just one day after the other. Sometimes there might be an event that we can rationalize the price action by. But over the long term, big trends do change the fundamentals. And that is one of the big lessons that we can take from these very long-term trends in terms of price action. So when you have a very long-term range, then it's not interesting. There's less investment because people don't want, and if you go down to the bank and you say, "Well, I want to invest, I want to borrow a lot of money and invest because I think prices are going to do nothing for the next decade," well, then the bankers are going to be less likely to give you money. On the other hand, when prices have been rallying for 5 or 6 years already, and you go into the bank and say, "Here's a linear projection, and I think the price is going to be double what it is now in the next 3 or 4 years. I need to borrow money now so that we can all benefit from that price appreciation," you're more likely to get your money. So therefore, by the time all that money has then been invested and a lot of new supply comes into the market, well, that's a lot of supply coming in at a period when prices are already very high, and then you get a reversal. And these triple waterfall effects that you get at the top of commodity bull markets are not isolated incidents. They have tended to happen throughout history, where you get interest rates rising and you get a lot of new supply coming in at just the time when you're about to have a recession. So you get this triple waterfall effect. Well, that is one of the ways in which the trend can change the fundamentals of the market. Generally speaking, a bull market does not end because demand evaporates, but rather because supply increases. And bull markets start because supply is inhibited, that you get periods of supply inelasticity because prices have been going sideways for so long, and because the businesses have been largely marginal, that they don't have the wherewithal to increase supply in a dynamic manner when a new source of demand appears. And it can take decades for a new source of demand to appear. And that is what contributes to these very long-term ranges. So when we think about what is the upside potential for commodity prices, the likelihood is that these commodity prices could potentially go back up towards their peaks, but are unlikely to sustain those moves. And this is also fitting into the potential that we're in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market. Now, there are three psychological perception stages to a bull market, and to go through the detail of all of them takes approximately 2.5 hours, that's one of the really fun parts of the second day of the chart seminar. But I'll summarize them for you, and it is simply that you get disbelief, where people are in the base formation or in the range and they don't believe that things are going to get better. Then you get acceptance because you get a breakout and things are doing well, and there's nothing like making money to improve your perception of what the upside potential is. And then there's the third one, which climaxes in euphoria, where you take what was a good story, and then it is juiced by leverage, and it prices in progressively more of the future into current prices, and that's when things start to get really quite silly. And of course, it's also when we make money fastest. So when we think about it in those scenarios, generally speaking, when you're in the period of the third psychological perception stage, things have been doing well for a while already, and then people start to get really enthusiastic. And they get enthusiastic because they've got ample potential, they've got ample personal experience of things doing well. I'm up here in Big Bear at the moment, sharing a house with some friends, and when the Dow Jones went through 25,000, that it became a talking point at dinner last night, that everyone was really rubbing their hands together, and there was this sort of feeling around the table, well, aren't we all so smart and fortunate? Isn't this just wonderful? And what that also helps to highlight is that there's a feel-good factor that comes with a market that is doing frightfully well, and that people are delighted with their strategy, and they don't want to see the good news ending. And right now, there is no evidence that it's about to end, but at the same time, we know that when things have been doing so very well for so long, when storied hedge funds like Brevan Howard are not doing well because their hedging is not working, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that these guys have suddenly turned from being almost visionary in their ability to hedge markets into people that are incapable of outperforming, but rather that hedging strategies generally have not worked. So what that means is very simple, that we have had a momentum move. And the kinds of strategies that work best in momentum moves are those that don't hedge. The pace of the Dow Jones advance has been picking up, and it is beginning to accelerate. And that's beginning to price in progressively more good news for the future. And of course, we have had a major good news event with the introduction of a massive fiscal stimulus in the form of tax cuts for the US economy. And of course, the consumer is a big part of the US economy. And the kinds of things that do best in this kind of environment are those that are leveraged to the growth of the global economy. So commodities fit very squarely into that. Eventually, we do get inflation, so that's really not good news for bonds, but it's really positive for equity prices. So when you get people that are really enthusiastic, then you get accelerations. Accelerations are an ending, but there are a number of things that we can look at as potential lead indicators for what an ending might look like. Well, central banks have killed off more bull markets than just about anything else. And when they start to raise interest rates, and when interest rates become a headwind, then it has an impact on high yield spreads. Right now, there is no indication that high yield spreads are expanding. In fact, they contracted this week. So what that suggests is that this is a canary that is still singing like Pavarotti. So everything on that regard still looks fine. Then we do not have unemployment that is increasing. If unemployment was rising, then that would be indicative of stress in the economy. That's not happening either. Government bonds have not rolled over. And then because high yield is still doing fine, then companies that have benefited most from access to easy liquidity remain still reasonably steady. Tesla, for example, is still holding above this $300 area. And again, this was another week in which it had a delay in the rollout of the Model 3. And so far, the market has taken that in its stride. And the market is taking that in its stride because the company has no problem sourcing liquidity. And that's because high yield spreads are still very, very narrow. Eventually, when those high yield spreads start to expand, well, then these highly leveraged companies with no earnings are going to run into some trouble. So, what I think that suggests is that you can either look at Tesla or you can look at high yield spreads, and both will likely give us a lead indicator for stress in the wider economy. That then suggests that there is ample potential for catch up. If the US is moving into the third psychological perception stage and has already been rallying for a significant period of time, then there is potential for catch up in a significant number of additional markets. And I think subscribers will be familiar with my contention that Japan is one of the most interesting markets right now, because the TOPIX index is at a new recovery high. It has not traded at levels like this for decades, and it broke out in this week. So I think that this is the beginning of a new bull market in Japan. And the TOPIX banks index, which has lagged for decades and is one of the clearest base formations anywhere, then this suggests to me that TOPIX, the Japanese banking sector, is one of the few remaining big base formations out there. That as an asset class, as a globally significant asset, then the Japanese banks are, I think, among the most attractive of anywhere. But when we look at Europe, if we simply look at the Europe Stoxx 600, which is a pan-European index, then it is coming up to the upper side of a 17-year range, and there is potential that it will break higher in 2018. If we limit that to the Eurozone, then it is still way below the peak around the I think it's the 450 area, and there is potential that it's at least going to go up and test that area in here in 2018. The FTSE 100 has already broken out of its range, and it continues to outperform the European indices. not least because of the relative weakness of the pound in 2016, but it was breaking up and out of that range in here this week. And this also represents the beginning of a new bull market, that when you see something that has gone sideways for, in this case, 16 years, then breaks upwards, then it's doing so for a reason. And considering what's in the FTSE 100, then it is the commodity complex that is lending a tailwind to the index. And it is synchronized global economic expansion because it's a very global index, and it's denominated in pounds, and the pound was quite weak in 2016 and indeed in 2015, which led it up to these levels. So all of these are coalescing to push the market onto new high ground. And when we look at, for example, some of the pure commodity-based markets, then the Brazilian market is breaking up and are at least coming up to test the upper side of this range and then breaking out and at new all-time highs on a nominal basis. And obviously we had some profound currency depreciation in during the commodity bust. So we can't simply ignore what's going on in terms of the currency, but the most important point right now is that the currency is in fact appreciating, and that the 4 real to the dollar area was a significant area of support back in 2015, and the currency has been reasonably steady since, and that's despite I think what could only be described as a crazy situation where just about every politician in the country has been implicated in some form of bribery or another. Well, what we're also seeing, for example, is that the Colombian peso has been one of the best performing currencies so far this year. And it pretty much halved between 2014 and early 2016, and now it is coming. The dollar is coming down to test the lower side of this range, and a break lower would reassert demand dominance for the or I think if I remember correctly, the ticker is GXG for the Colombian ETF. When we look at, for example, an ETF for the Colombian market, it had this enormous decline in 2014 and 2015, not least because of the currency, where the price went from over 20 to about 7, and then it has held this progression of higher reaction low since, and looks to be on the cusp of breaking upwards once more. So it isn't simply that we are getting a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and we have an increasing number of markets that are breaking higher and doing better, but that this has been, I think, largely fueled by synchronized monetary expansion. And this monetary expansion is now giving way to economic expansion. But what that is also going to do is represent a really quite significant transition in terms of the global economy over the course of the next 18 months or 2 years as interest rates begin to rise. When we think about the rise of the global consumer, then this is a very long-term evolution, and it is, I think, largely appropriate from the perspective of the big picture long-term audio, that there are two, I think, largely competing points, that in many respects, commodity prices, as they move higher, are inflationary in nature. But at the other side of the equation, you have technology. And I think there are two important points about the rise of, or I think the, about technological innovation. One is the pace of innovation, and the pace of innovation is improving all the time. It isn't simply about Moore's Law. Moore's Law, when applied to semiconductors, has pretty much approximated its limits already. That is that we enjoyed a doubling of efficiency, or it was in fact a doubling of the number of transistors on a chip every 18 months for the better part of about 40 years. And because those chips are now so very small, then we've pretty much got down to about as small as they're going to be. So different architectures are being employed, and that is helping to create more efficiencies. One of the reasons that Arm Holdings was acquired by SoftBank was because of the different way that they are producing their chips and focusing more on RAM and speed rather than computing power. So there are a number of different ways to continue to increase this efficiency in chips. And when we look at, for example, the semiconductor index, then what it suggests is that there isn't any particular problem in the slowdown in Moore's law. Rather, that because we're in a period of synchronized economic expansion, and that we have a substantial number of people that are moving up into the middle classes, that they're entering the period where demand for electronics is rising, and that is really helping to stoke demand for chips. So that is one point, that with technological innovation becoming more available, that in previous cycles, technology would have really have only been available within the OECD, and then most particularly within the country where it is originally created. But in the context of a global economy, that technology becomes available instantly everywhere, and then it is only a question of the ability of people to afford it. So I think that is one of the more important points, is the availability of technology is inherently deflationary, because most particularly in countries where they can avoid having to invest in pieces of infrastructure so that they can leapfrog whole stages of development, then that becomes a massive growth opportunity, but it can be achieved with very little inflation. And that's what we're seeing in India, that Indian inflation hasn't been under control like it is right now for a considerable period. And what that is doing is helping to put some, I think, confidence back into the exchange rate. And when we look at the rupee, then it trended lower for what must have felt like forever. But when we look at this on a log scale chart, then we get some more context. And that was an incredible depreciation between about early 2008 and the lows in 2013. But now we've seen that the progression of lower rally highs has been broken, and that the rupee is at a new recovery high at the end of this week. This is incredibly meaningful. This is something that if we had said back in 2013 that the rupee would be back on a recovery trajectory anytime at all, you would have been laughed out of court. And what we're now seeing is that India is benefiting from the rollout of these of 4G, which is opening up the potential for online banking, and it's opening up the potential for hundreds of millions of illiterate people to have I think a real participation in not just their domestic economy but the global economy, that the availability of education assets and entertainment, banking and retail on the web, and giving access to that to everyone everywhere is a really quite a significant enhancement to the human condition. And the fact that it can be done with and I think, well, obviously it can't be done with no investment, but that the rewards that are reaped from it are so profound that it helps to control inflation. That also helps to feed through to the point that if we're going to have an inflationary cycle coming out once more, then it's likely to be socially driven and coming more from the OECD than it is from the emerging markets. And I think that that is where we have one of the really big changes that is going on in the global economy right now. when we think about technology, then it isn't simply about the greater availability of that technology, but also that it is the pace of that innovation that is picking up. That we had a major bull market in the 1990s because we had the introduction of the internet, and we also had the what it was. If we cast our minds back, it was referred to as the TMT boom, which was technology, media, and telecommunications. But a lot of that was tied into the mobile phone market and the internet, and it was the build out of the infrastructure required to power the internet. Everything from routers to search engines and to browsers like AOL and Netscape that helped to drive the interest in e-commerce and the internet. But what we're seeing today is an acceleration in the number of sectors that are expanding and innovating in an exponential manner. So when we take, for example, what's going on in the biotechnology sector, that the milestones that have been reached in the last few years are pretty astounding. For example, the microbiome was discovered in the 1880s, but the Human Microbiome Project didn't start until 2008. It was completed in 2013, and it represents an almost brand new area of medical discovery that has the potential to really tackle some of the chronic conditions that are beginning to cripple the health systems of within the OECD, not least obesity and diabetes. Then, and when we look at that's just one within the biotechnology sector, the invention of CRISPR gene editing technology, which was only 3 years ago, has both reduced the cost of gene editing and improved the efficiency and speed to such an extent that this discovery has gone from nowhere to almost complete penetration of just about every biotechnology lab in the world in the space of about 3 years. So that is speeding up the pace of innovation in the biotechnology sector. And those are just two things. Then you have immuno-oncology. And the immuno-oncology sector is, I think, only just beginning to reach commercialization. It was something that was being talked about during the TMT bubble, but while it was an idea back then, it is reaching commercial utility today. And that is helping to stoke a recovery in the biotechnology sector. These are incredibly exciting innovations when taken in isolation, but they're only in one sector. Healthcare is something that is incredibly powerful, not only because if we have better health outcomes, people work longer and have the potential to reach their productive capacity. It's another example of the speed of innovation being one thing and the availability of that innovation being something else. That as people move into the middle classes, their demand for healthcare also increases because obviously you work really hard to lift yourself up out of poverty, and then it's nice to also enjoy the fruits of your labor, and you can't do that if you're dead. So obviously, healthcare then is a significant bull market all on its own. Then, when we look at the energy sector, this has been a couple of decades where we have seen incredible innovation there as well, where we have now got drills that can go horizontal. They can go out in a not just go horizontal in a short way, but can go for miles, both deep and wide. That you have hydraulic fracturing, you have ultra deep wells that previously the pre-salt offshore in Brazil was impossible to get to because of just how difficult the environment is. But that is no longer an surmountable challenge, although it is still an expensive one. Well, news today that researchers have developed iron oxide batteries, at least in the lab, is an indication that we can expect that battery technology is going to improve within the coming decades. And that has the potential also to be inherently deflationary, because it is going to represent a massive transition in the transportation sector. And when we think about it in those terms, then what it is going to have is massive social ramifications, that the number of jobs that can be pursued by people that do not have a strong education is going to reduce further. And in many respects, it has been men that were most affected by globalization in the first round of globalization. But when we think about the potential for revolution in the transportation sector, well, then it is going to be both men and women are going to be affected. In one regard, it is men that are primarily drivers. And then when we think about the roboticization of the garment industry and the automation of the factory floor, well, it is mostly women in the emerging markets that are the workers on factory floors. So that represents a significant challenge. The creation of online retail represents a significant challenge for companies that have depended for ever so long on the retail market. Debenhams in the UK this week came through with rather disappointing figures for the sales period before Christmas, and it was at a new low. So coming back down towards those lows seen in 2008. But of course, if what we saw, for example, in the coal sector, when a number of those companies were going bust, it was that the survivors were the ones that were able to come through this very difficult period, and they benefited from the bankruptcies of some of their competitors. And for example, while Debenhams was deteriorating this week, Next came through with better figures. So there is the potential for recovery in at least some of these shares. And it's, for example, when we look at Whitehaven Coal in Australia, then it's a similar story that we had substantial numbers of bankruptcies in the coal sector, but it's still a significant sector. And even in a declining sector like coal burning fuel, then it still has years left to run. And I think that that is something similar to what we're going to see in the retail sector, that there will obviously still be some retail stores that will survive because they have been nimble enough to change. But those that are not nimble will disappear. And again, this is, represents massive social change. And again, that is why it is in the social arena that we're most likely to see pressure on inflation. Because people will vote for more money, and governments will come into power in various different forms in various different countries and come up with different ways of making sure that people have more money. So the pace of technological innovation is deflationary on one hand, but inflationary on the other, because it is deflationary on the cost front and inflationary on the social front. This is the, I think, what we're going to see in the context of this bull market over the next 20 years, that it will be the companies that are driving the innovation are going to be among the greatest beneficiaries. But their prices are also going to improve because we get an inflationary bias coming through in the markets. Now, when we think about the medium-term bull market that we've had for the last 9 years, we are in the third psychological perception stage. So this is the time to really monitor consistency characteristics, because what that also means, when we're in the third psychological perception stage, it is when people become most self-satisfied. It's when people start to think that they are due the Nobel Prize for economics personally, and that we tend to be most tempted to lose the run of ourselves, and most particularly if we're fully invested. And there is no reason not to be fully invested when prices are improving at this rate. But if that is indeed the case, then we need to be vigilant for top formation characteristics, and an evolving acceleration is a potential trend ending when it eventually turns, that's likely to represent a peak of at least medium-term significance. And it will have far-reaching effects, that if we do get a big blowout in terms of an accelerating market, then we're going to have excesses, and those excesses will be unwound, that we will have a recession, that there is no secular bull market that persists for decades, that isn't punctuated by recessions, but that in the context of a secular bull market, recessions are buying opportunities. And I think that that will be something to really bear in mind in the context of looking at markets all the way I think passing through 2018 and into 2019. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.